I knew we had a turn coming up, and I didn't want to wake him up, so I glanced down at the map that was on his lap. And that was my mistake.
And something so backwards as your daughter dying first before you happens. You find yourself in a place you've never been before, a wilderness with neither map nor compass.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. I'm Jessica Henkin.
And I am Laura Wexler. This week on the podcast, When Up Is Down, two stories about really difficult experiences that put the storyteller on a really, really different path than they expected.
Before we get started, we want to thank our sponsor, the Park School of Baltimore, which is an independent, progressive pre-K through grade 12 school located right outside of Baltimore.
So this first story is by Danton Spina, who's an architect, a writer, and a storyteller. And he's worked in theater and had plays produced. And this story is about a big adventure that commences after high school. And as it often turns out, it's not the adventure that he had planned on. So take a listen.
As a kid, I never really traveled anywhere outside of New Jersey. And I felt like I was living a pretty cookie-cutter, blah existence. Even all the way up into high school, just felt like I was going through the motions of what it meant to be a kid or a high schooler or an average American. Nothing that exciting ever seemed to happen. So I grew up, you know, on these movies of the 80s and 90s that I was inspired by, like Road Trip and Dumb and Dumber, Tommy Boy, Wild America, really, you know, intelligent, intellectual, complicated road trip movies. So I was inspired to create my own road trip, this big, epic two-month trip. So you would think that would be easy to sell to parents of a high school student, but it was not. I went through dozens of people. I'm not even joking. But I did land on a good friend who had been friends with me for 15 years, my friend Jeff, and his parents were on board too. And you know, he was a very mellow guy. He's a great friend. And I was always jealous of his family because they had traveled everywhere. And so first day of our road trip, we start the adventure. We're both in the car together. He's driving his dad's Honda Element. We just get on the highway, and Jeff, going pretty fast on the highway, hits one of those giant trash barrel-sized construction cones. First day. And it caused a dent. And I'm like, you know, we got to tell your dad about this. And he's like, I'll get to it. No, don't worry about it. So that goes on the whole trip. I'm just like, you should tell your dad. Weeks and weeks into it. No, that's okay. I'm not going to tell him. So 6 weeks into the trip, we're in northeast Arizona. And we're driving in the middle of a Navajo reservation. And I'm driving the car. He was my navigator. And he had fallen asleep. And I knew we had a turn coming up, and I didn't want to wake him up. So I glanced down at the map that was on his lap. And that was my mistake. And I drifted to the right a little bit. And we're going about 80 miles an hour. And sagebrush and dirt starts kicking up. And I'm a relatively new driver right out of high school. And I panic. And I turn sharply to the left. Sharply is not a good move at that speed. The other side also was not as flat. It dropped down a few feet. So at about 80 miles an hour, we dropped off the other side of the road and hit the ground full speed, and the car flipped. And everything was kind of a blur. It was just blue, green, blue, green, blue, green. And then the car landed upright. And I did what anybody does instinctively in this moment. I turned to my right and I said, "Are you okay?" And Jeff wasn't there. So my heart dropped. And I look at what was left, the void where his window was. His car door was peeled back like a can of sardines. And I panic, but my seatbelt's stuck, and I can't get out. So I see it I can kind of reach the glove compartment. I pull out one of those cutter knives out of the glove compartment. I manage to cut my seatbelt off, and I try to get my door. But now my door is also jammed and pinned in. So I have to climb through that hole where he presumably just went through. And so I panic and I climb through this hole. I land on the ground. I'm trying to run, but I stumble because I'm so exhausted and just confused. And I'm looking around everywhere and I'm just yelling, "Jeff, Jeff!" And I can't seem to get oriented. The road seems like it's in the wrong place. And I realized the car had spun 180 degrees while it was flipping. So I had everything backwards. So I run around to the other side of the car, and I saw the most horrifying thing I've ever seen in my life. In the field of green-gray sagebrush, I see a white t-shirt and dust and blood. And my best friend is there. He's not breathing. He's not moving. I can't even move myself. So I just try to make my way towards him. And as I get closer, he's still not moving. I'm panicking. My heart's racing. And I kind of just start tapping his chest. You know, Jeff. Jeff. And then I heard that gasp of air. And he took a deep breath. And thankfully, he started breathing. I said, oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And he's not fully coherent, but he starts to breathe. And I say, Jeff, what's your name? And he coughs a little bit, but he does manage to sort of sputter out, Jeff. So I knew he was there enough. And then in that moment, a haze of things happened. I remember hearing the siren break the silence, and then it was a whirlwind. It was ambulance to a Navajo clinic. The Navajo clinic didn't have a proper MRI, so we had to do something else, and they were trying to figure that out. We got a phone call from someone that was a birthday call for me, horribly timed. I called his parents. I called my parents. We were trying to figure this out. Finally, he gets cleared to travel. We go to an airstrip and fly 200 miles to Flagstaff. Through turbulence, the plane plummets and levels out just in time, and we make it to Flagstaff, and he gets his MRI. And after all that, he goes through surgery, and when he came out of surgery, he had no broken bones, surprisingly, no internal trauma of any kind, and all he had was this big laceration on his leg that was peeled open, much like the car door, and in that was all dust and sagebrush, but they fixed it, they cleaned it out, and he had 46 staples to put it all back together. But when we're in the hospital, he finally wakes up, and again, I'm just profusely apologizing. I'm so sorry. And him being his mellow self just says, oh, it's all good, man. It's all good. And it's like the first thing he says. And then the second thing he says was, at least I don't have to tell my dad about the dent. And I realized in that moment, obviously he was going to be okay. So we flew home, and everything was fine. He Jeff got home fine. And one of the things that happened with this moment, though, is it was a trigger for me in my life. And you would think from that you would come out of it being very cautious. But I actually had the opposite effect on me. You know, obviously, I always make sure someone has a seatbelt on, because Jeff didn't have his seatbelt on in that situation. But otherwise, in other avenues of my life, I feel like I take more risks. It kind of pushed me to break outside of the mundane life and realize I could do what I wanted to do. I could go after these things that I wanted to, however risky or not risky. But the point is, I could go after the things I wanted to. And I always think about that moment. If Jeff hadn't survived, I think both of us kind of would have died in Arizona in some way. And that always has been in my mind. And so since then, I've made a point of traveling more and kind of going on these crazy adventures. I've been to Costa Rica. I've been thrown out of some whitewater rafting boats. And I've been in some mountains with fire in them. You know what that is. I've climbed some of those. I've also most recently jumped out of a plane with just a backpack on. You know, so all this stuff. And it just has always made me think about being open to your future, living life with intention as you move forward. And I just like to do that every day, and it's all thanks to this incident with my friend Jeff. So thank you.
Yeah, this story made me just so worried for my own son after listening to it. I know that's selfish, but I just feel like any time that, you know, young men get in cars, it's like, oh, nail biting.
Yeah,
me.
Yeah. Well, and just the flipping over of cars and then the walking out, you know, the walking out of that alive. And just when he says, you know, if my friend had died, you know, both of our lives would have ended on that road. And then also the idea that, like, something like that could make you scared, could make you make your life smaller so that you would never be in that position again. And instead it had the opposite.
Yeah.
And I think that's true. I think you cannot predict how these kinds of massive experiences will change you, which is part of, you know, it's part of the deal. Before we get on to the next story, we want to thank Baltimore Magazine. They're at baltimoremagazine.com and also on newsstands. You can check them out for all sorts of good stories about Baltimore, restaurants, events, all of that, and their podcast, Baltimore Boomerang. And we want to thank Golden West on the Avenue with all of their funky and cool decor, their awesome vegan and Southwestern food and pancakes and French toast and crepes and all sorts of great stuff.
I'm hungry.
Always, they're always doing something new there. So, so you can go back and never the same place twice. Okay, this next story for today is told by Peter Brune, and he is an artist and an educator and a curator and a community activist. He has run several different arts organizations that have to do with bringing people in, connecting people with arts, bringing people in, and still kept up his own practice as an artist. And he's told a story before, was unforgettable. I think this one is exactly just as unforgettable. Take a listen.
I was married pretty much right out of college. She loved me. I loved her. We were compatible in every way. We had a family. We agreed on what to do with them. We supported each other. Our love was simple. Our love was easy. Our marriage was nearly perfect for nearly 30 years. Now, those of you who have children know that there's a bright line between life before children and life after children. There's another bright line having to do with before and after. On February 11th, 2014, my wife and I received a phone call letting us know that our 24-year-old daughter, Elisif, had died of an overdose. Not so much joy on the other side of that bright line. Everything changed. For me, I started the New Day campaign. As Aaron said, a project using art to challenge stigma and discrimination associated with mental illness and substance use, making the world a more healing place. My wife, she needed to be. She needed silence. She needed to be away, which for her meant moving to Maine, where Elisif's old boyfriend, Gordon, was lost and hurting just as she was. It was hard, but our love was still so easy and necessary. Our family wondered at our apartness. You could see it on their faces, and we wanted nothing to do with that. Despite our separateness, we were solid. No question. Fuck the doubters. So it was for 2.5 years. Me here, her there, us tethered by a lifeline called love across all that distance. Summer 2016, we would talk to each other on the phone. We had 3 phone conversations that week, and 5 minutes into each call, we were arguing. That never happened. That was confusing. That summer was also the summer I developed a crush on another woman. Now, I hadn't had a crush since college, when I actually had a crush on another woman just about every week. 30 years later, I found myself schoolboyishly in love. Of course, I told my wife about it because that's the kind of relationship we have. We believe that so long as each of us is trying to be our best self, nothing can come between us. And this felt like that. It's not that we weren't afraid, because we were, but we believed we would be okay. And we were. Nothing came of that crush. My wife and I believed in our marriage. Despite the distance that she needed to maintain, despite the healing that I needed and didn't know where to find, we felt solid. Our love neither wanted nor waned. And yet, there was a hole in my heart from my daughter's death. And that crush held out the promise of something both terrifying and exhilarating. It was just about then I got the email from Lee. She wrote me, "Dear Peter, you may not remember me, but we lived in the same dorm freshman year of college. You were in a dream I had the other night, and I don't believe in coincidences, so I decided to write and say hi." I wrote back, "Of course I remember you. I had a crush on you freshman year." Well, it turns out, I got that email when I was in Baltimore, and it turns out that just a few days later I was headed up to Maine, and it happened to be that Lee lived just about exactly halfway on the way, not 5 minutes off the highway. So I visited. You can probably guess where this is going. And you're probably right, at least in part. I fell in love with Lee. It was magical and restorative. I found I had fun with Lee. I felt happy. I did not feel lonely for the first time since Elisif had died. I found healing, and I was so in love. When up is up and down is down, when the rules are clear, it's easy to know what it means to be true. But when life delivers you something that turns up, down, and down, up, when something so backwards as your daughter dying first before you happens, you find yourself in a place you've never been before, a wilderness with neither map nor compass. It's a lot harder to know what it means to be true. It's a lot harder to know what it means to be trustworthy. Some places that I've found myself where I never expected to be. In a relationship with two women at the same time, believing perhaps this is the way that this bigamous dynamic could hold. Maintaining a relationship with two women for over a year in secret. Only Lee, my wife, a few very close friends knowing, friends and family not knowing. I never lied, but I sure did some heavy-duty ducking and dodging. Twice, I broke up with Lee. One time, just 1 week after her mother died. 1 week after her mother died, I left her for my wife. Twice, I left my wife for another woman, that woman being Lee. Nothing was simple anymore. Everything was confusing. Everything was shit unnavigable. So I entered therapy. My breakthrough came when I realized the question wasn't, who do I want to be with? But the question was, what do I want? What do I want and need for myself and my life? And posing the question that way, I developed the clarity that had been so elusive. I knew the answer. Either way, there would be pain, but I knew the answer. Either way, there would be betrayal, but I knew. Either way, I was going to hurt someone I deeply loved as much as anything in the world, so deeply. But I knew the answer. Lines of a poem that play like a loop in my head. I want to know if you can disappoint another to be true to yourself. If you can bear the accusation of betrayal and not betray your own soul. If you can be faithless and therefore trustworthy. When death happens, when transformational grief and pain abide, everything changes. You change. It changes you. I'm not going to tell you who I'm with. That's not the point of the story. The point of the story is a point of pain. When my daughter was using drugs, she used because she was in pain. That pain grabbed her by the nose and took her to places where she never thought she would be, to a place where up is down and down is up, and she did not recognize herself. That is what pain will do to you. It did it to me. And for better or worse, it does it to everyone. I think about Elisif. And as I stand here sharing this story, I feel so close to her. So close to her journey of pain down the rabbit hole to a place where she was a passenger on the ride of her own life. I remember what a friend of hers told me, a friend who said that when she introduced him to heroin, she said to him, first she shot him up, she paused, she stopped, she looked at him, and she said, "This changes you. It changes you." How right she was. Thank you.
When he told the story the night of the show, the audience, you could tell, just didn't know how to be there for them. They wanted so badly to be there for him. And everyone had such a compassionate and sad energy.
Yeah.
But he, interestingly, I think, is at a place where he has worked through so much of this tragedy that he just seemed more composed than the audience, and that was an interesting thing to watch.
And I think it's because, in a way, what's unsettling about his story is the degree to which a massive loss or a grief breaks all the rules and frees you to do things that are taboo.
Yeah.
And that's unsettling for people to hear.
Right.
I think there's a lot of ways people don't want to acknowledge that, but that is exactly what I love about him, is to me that's so authentic and true.
And he just wants nothing but honesty at this point.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what he, you know, prizes over everything else. Okay. So we, after
you
that.
You need a good segue.
Yeah. You might want a stiff drink. Let's just be honest. Even if you do. If you don't, that's great. Good bully on you. That's awesome. If you do, you can go to the Wine Source, which is located at 3601 Elm Avenue in Hamden. If you like what you hear, if you could leave us a review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast. You can find out more about our live shows and workshops at stoopstorytelling.com. We are in the midst of announcing and proclaiming and letting everyone know about our 14th season in Baltimore. And if you can catch one of our shows, you really should.
You should.
You absolutely should.
And thank you to Maureen Harvey, who is our producer and a wonderful person. Thank you. See you next week.